It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up, we'll get an inside look at the student athletes who challenged the NCAA. But first, we're talking about a new project that zoos around the country are taking part in to help with some of the conservation efforts for tigers. Now, not every tiger sounds the same, and so the Pruston Project is a global effort that's recording the unique sounds that tigers in captivity make. It's kind of like taking a vocal fingerprint to get a better idea of how many tigers are still left in the wild. Wisconsin's Milwaukee County Zoo is the only Midwestern zoo to be working with the Pruston Project to record the voices of tigers, and those new recordings are going to sound something like this. Here to tell us more is Courtney Dunn, founder and executive director of the Pruston Project, who's researched how tiger vocalizations can be used to identify individual animals. And also joining us in a little bit, we'll have Amanda Ista with us as well. She's a zookeeper at the Milwaukee County Zoo working with tigers that are being studied. Courtney, welcome to you.
Good afternoon.
And Amanda, great to have you along as well.
Good afternoon.
And Courtney, we'll start with you. What made you decide that we should start paying attention to the way that tigers sound when it comes to monitoring their conservation?
Well, several years ago when whale conservation really took off, something that helped gain public interest in the cause was the fact that whales seemed to be singing songs in the ocean. And when I first started working with tigers, I started noticing such a wide range of calls they make, and it was kind of a funny idea at the time that, hey, maybe we could use tiger songs to help people care about them. That simple thought just slowly turned into, well, let's see what's in these vocalizations. Maybe there actually is something in these vocalizations that we could use to help them.
Well, it's an interesting thing, Amanda. I'm going to turn to you. I've take my children to the zoo. I love to watch animals, to see them at zoos, and I haven't ever heard a tiger vocalize. I don't think of tigers as being very vocal animals. Are they, Amanda?
Actually, they are pretty vocal. The tigers are probably the most vocal cats that we have behind the lions. The lions tend to call to each other a little bit more, but our tigers are pretty vocal, and it depends on individual tigers, but this new guy that we got in is actually very vocal.
Who's the new guy?
His name is Stronic. We got him in about a couple months ago from Toledo Zoo, so he's here to breed with one of our females, and he's definitely making his presence known. You can hear him on the outside floor when he's in the back holding area, so people knew he was here even before he went on exhibit.
And Courtney, what do we know so far about tigers' voices, and what can we learn from them?
So the specific call that we study is something called a long call. A lot of people actually refer to it as a true roar because it's what that example was at the beginning of this show. What we know from that is that it can travel anywhere from 2 to over 3 miles away. And tigers use that a lot to communicate with each other long distance. From anything from just saying, hey, I'm here, to, hey, get out of my territory. With our project, what we found with that is that that vocalization is extremely unique per individual. And there's also clues in those calls to whether the individual calling is male or female. So, as you mentioned earlier, it's kind of like a vocal fingerprint from just one sound they make.
And it sounds as though the vocalizations of male and female tigers are pretty distinct. What is the difference, Courtney?
So it's just like a human. If you were to be speaking to a guy, you'd probably notice that he usually has a deeper voice than perhaps you. And it's the same with most animals, but especially with tigers. They have a really deep voice if they're a male, and the females tend to have a higher vocalization. What's really interesting about this is the females are a lot easier to tell apart amongst each other than males amongst other males. So males typically sound about the same. They're only different to a few degrees, but the females can vary quite a bit on a range.
And Amanda, I want to bring you in on this. Now, have you started recording the tigers yet at the Milwaukee County Zoo?
We have. We've been recording them on and off probably for about a month or so now.
What is that process like?
It's actually really easy, which makes it really nice to do because we don't have to do a ton with it. We just set the recorder up, we make sure it's working, and then we move it to the closest spot to where the tiger is. So we rotate our tigers on a pretty regular basis between their indoor holding, their outdoor exhibit, and their indoor exhibit. So wherever the tiger goes, it kind of follows them. It doesn't go in with them, but we move it near them. So it will be the closest to that tiger.
And is there a special kind of microphone that you're using? Any sort of tiger-ready microphone?
It's actually a device that Courtney probably knows a lot more about. She made it very easy for us to just set up and get going and hook up the microphone, so she could probably tell you a little more details on that.
Courtney, what is the microphone like?
Yeah, so it is very anticlimactic to look at this recorder. You think it's going to be one fancy piece of equipment, and there are some really fancy-looking recorders and microphones out there. But the one we use is just a green bar. There's no features on the outside. It's just solid green. And it's just a simple little acoustic microphone that sticks off to one side. And most people, when they look at it, they think you're just carrying around a little green box, but they don't realize that on the inside is this huge computer system that can collect such a wide range of sound.
Talking with Courtney Dunn right now, founder of the Prouston Project, which records the vocal communications of tigers in American zoos to understand how they're surviving in the wild. And also, Amanda Ista is with us as well from the Milwaukee County Zoo, where she's a zookeeper and someone who is recording the vocalizations of tigers. And Courtney, Milwaukee is one of the zoos that's participating in this Prouston Project. What other zoos are you working with?
Oh, there are several of them. I feel like the list increases every day as more find out about us and start contacting us to contribute. One of probably the most familiar facilities that people that's actually in our project is the San Diego Safari Park. We'll actually be traveling to them in April, about mid-April, to go record their collection of tigers. But we've also recorded at the Tulsa Zoo, Topeka Zoo, and even the Dallas Zoo, which is right next door to where I work. So it kind of varies. We have people from all over the country that are interested in starting to contribute to our research.
So once you've got this collection of tiger vocalizations, what do you do with it?
So it is really not as complex as some people think. We are recording about 24-hour sets of sound from these tigers. And at first glance, you probably think that there's somebody sitting at a computer listening to 24-hour recordings of tigers, hoping they find something. But we actually have a program called Raven Pro that is used by Cornell. It was developed for birdsong research, but it can be used for just about anything. And with Raven Pro, we can take those files, and it turns a sound into a picture. And we look at these sound files in about 60-second segments. And those tiger calls, oddly enough, they show up as something that looks like tiger stripes.
Huh.
So they're very easy to find amongst all other sounds that we happen to pick up.
So then you've got this catalog, and then how do you use it for the conservation of tigers?
Mm-hmm. So we're currently still in the beginning stages of what we hope to accomplish. What we're using from the files right now is basically to determine how these tigers are unique, so what particular characteristics about their vocalizations make them a fingerprint. So we look at things called fundamental frequencies. We look at the duration that they call, amongst all other characteristics that we happen to find. And all of those characteristics combined make a unique profile for an individual tiger. Now, the goal is to eventually build this into a computer program to where if you put in any file, that computer program would be able to sort through the file automatically and say, oh, that's Tiger 52 or that's Tiger 68. The idea behind it is you can put that program in the wild and the recorder's in the wild, and any time a wild tiger vocalizes or passes by that recorder, you would instantly have information about the tiger without even seeing it.
And as we wrap up here, Courtney, how urgent are the efforts of tiger conservationists right now?
Most tiger subspecies are listed as endangered, but there actually are quite a few of them that are at the critical level, which is just one step above being declared extinct in the wild. There's about 3,200 tigers left in the wild, and that number dwindles every day. The biggest concern with this is, of course, no one ever wants to see a tiger not exist in the wild. But some people approach me and they're like, well, we'll always have tigers in zoos. We can always see them if we want. But the problem with tigers not being in the wild is they support their entire ecosystem. So without a tiger in place, those other animals in the ecosystem would no longer be able to exist. And slowly the forest would start collapsing. And this always raises the question, well, how does this affect me? I live here in the United States. That's occurring in Asia. How does it directly affect me? Well, what most people don't realize is a lot of our modern-day medicines still come from rainforests, and a lot of our products come from the rainforest, too. With a healthy rainforest, you can have a healthy life, even way over here in the United States, without even realizing it. So it's a very dire situation, but I have a lot of hope for it, especially with all these zoos that are very interested in helping out the cause.
Courtney, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Courtney Dunn, founder of the Pruston Project, which records the vocal communication of tigers in zoos to better understand how many there are in the wild. And Amanda Ista, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Amanda is a zookeeper in Wisconsin at the Milwaukee County Zoo, where she records the voices of tigers for the Pruston Project. Coming up, March Madness is upon us, and we'll get an insider look at the student athletes who challenge the NCAA and say the association exploits students. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump is leading the polls all over the country, even though he's not a career politician. We'll talk to a reporter who's been writing about a political science theory that might explain Donald Trump's popularity. But first, the NCAA March Madness basketball tournament begins this week. The annual tournament is the NCAA's most profitable business. Reports indicate the association earned roughly $900 million in revenue, most of which comes from the broadcast rights. Ben Strauss joins us now. His new book is called Indentured, the inside story of the rebellion against the NCAA. Ben, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, you write in the book that college athletes who make this money, others profit off of, but they never see a dime of it, are being exploited, kind of plain and simple. Why do you call this exploitation?
Well, I think you can look at the numbers and see pretty clearly that you have college sports is a $13 billion industry. That's more, if you can believe it, than the NFL today. The NCAA, as you mentioned, is going to bring in $900 million. Much of it from the March Madness tournament that is about to start. Coaches are making as much as $10 million a year. Mike Krzyzewski at Duke is the highest paid coach, college or professional in America. The conferences have their own TV networks, and they're pulling in $200, $300 million. And if you look at all the money swirling around college sports and the idea that the players don't see a dime of it, it's hard to come to any other conclusion that this is exploitation.
And the NCAA would probably say, well, these athletes are on scholarships. That's how they're being paid. These are amateur athletes. So what do you see that's wrong with that argument?
I think that you could defend the status quo a lot easier if the athletes were getting an education. But graduation rates for top-level football players and top-level basketball players are around 50%. And if you look at just what happened at North Carolina, where you had this academic scandal that went on for 25 years, where the school and the athletic department knew that athletes were being funneled into fake classes, you can see how secondary the education is to the athletics for so many of these athletes. And beyond North Carolina, there are studies that come out. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette did one. The Chronicle of Higher Education has done one. Where if you look at the majors of these athletes, you know, they're clustered into things like fitness studies and majors that aren't going to serve them, you know, beyond college. And so the idea that they're getting an education, what is supposed to make this grand bargain okay, just isn't happening.
You write that only, I think it's 5% of these college athletes do go on to play professional sports. So what would it mean for them if they did start to see some of the profits from their college career days?
Well, I spent some time with a former football player at Cal over the course of the O'Bannon trial, which was a lawsuit against the NCAA that said, you know, players deserved a piece of all of this money coming in. And he said, you know, that being a college athlete was wonderful. You get to play in the stadium. with thousands and thousands of people. You get to be on television. It's very glamorous in some senses. And then he said he graduated. He tried out for an NFL team. He didn't make it. And he didn't have a resume. He had nothing to fall back on. And now he drives for Lyft. He's basically a taxi driver. And so they're just not prepared for the next step in life. And if you equip them with a nest egg or some money, it would make that transition far easier, I think. And it's money that they've worked for and absolutely deserve.
We're talking with Ben Strauss right now, contributing writer for The New York Times and co-author of the book we're talking about. It's called Indentured, The Inside Story of the Rebellion Against the NCAA. And you open with a story about a basketball player, named Ryan Boatwright. Can you tell us a little bit of his story?
Yeah, so Ryan Boatwright was a basketball player at the University of Connecticut a few years ago. And he came under investigation by the NCAA. And as soon as you're suspected of any wrongdoing, this is how college sports worked, you know, you're guilty before innocent, he was suspended by his school, Connecticut. And the story, it turned out, was that the man making accusations to the NCAA was Ryan's mother's ex-boyfriend. And this terrible thing that the family had done was accept money for a plane ticket so that his mother could go on a recruiting visit with Ryan. Sort of this very basic thing that most parents can do who have money. And Ryan's mother, her name was Tanisha, her name is Tanisha, is a single mother with four kids. She's black and didn't have the means to go with her son on these recruiting visits. And so a family friend paid for them. And the NCAA, you know, gets this tip from an angry ex-boyfriend who has a vendetta against the family and is vengeful against the Boatwrights. And they basically swoop in and almost terrorize Tanisha. They, take her to a hotel room and there's four agents and they, you know, badger her about every check she's written over the last few years. And she says this was for Christmas presents. And they say, well, how do we know? They went to her workplace. And they went to her friends' houses and her friends' workplaces. And this is so traumatic that she ends up losing her job over, you know, taking a little bit of money to go on a recruiting trip with her son.
Well, in a story like this, I mean, what sort of legal recourse does an athlete or their family have if they get a disagreement like this with the NCAA?
That's actually a fantastic question. The answer is they have no recourse because a Supreme Court decision from the 1980s said that the NCAA does not have to provide due process to anybody it investigates. And that means sometimes you don't know who has made accusations against you. You don't know what those accusations are. And you don't have access to the evidence that's been, submitted against you. You have no rights.
One aspect of this book that is growing, the chorus of voices growing, talking about this, saying that there is a racial element to these NCAA rules and that they unfairly disadvantage black players. What are people saying about that?
Yeah, I think that this absolutely is a civil rights issue because upper middle class families who tend to be whiter and tend to, you know, have more means at their disposal are able to navigate these rules. When you are poor and you're black, just like what happened with Tanisha, you don't have the wherewithal to navigate the system. Whereas somebody who has means and who has more money is. And so if you look also at the composition of these athletes in top-level football and top-level basketball, the vast majority of them are black. And so when the NCAA or these rules just given the construct of the way college sports is set up, tend to negatively impact African Americans more than they do white people.
And given the cultural backdrop of where our country is right now, the Black Lives Matter movement, looking at systemic inequality, do you see particularly this advantage getting a little traction right now?
Yeah, I think I think it is a way to shine a light on this. I would say also that you can look at what happened at Missouri just recently, or last year, where the football team was part of a movement to protest racism on campus. And these were issues that had been percolating for a while on campus. And as soon as the football team announced that we are not going to play until these issues are sorted out, the president resigned within 36 hours. And so we can see just how much power the football team has because of how much money is tied up in these games being played with the TV contracts and the TV networks, that there is so much power that that players do have. And if they are able to use their voices, they can make change.
Ben, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
That was Ben Strauss, a contributing writer for The New York Times and co-author of the new book called Indentured, the inside story of the rebellion against the NCAA. The book looks at the backlash against the NCAA's policies surrounding student athletes and profit. Coming up, we'll talk to a reporter who's been writing about the relationship between authoritarianism and Donald Trump. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret will be back tomorrow. Coming up, the Senate ended their two-year session today with a marathon meeting. We'll talk to WPR State Capitol reporter about which bills made the calendar and which bills didn't. First, here's Donald Trump last Friday at a rally in Missouri where people were being removed for protesting the Republican candidate.
They realize that there are no consequences to protesting anymore. There used to be consequences. There are none anymore. So that's it. All right. Thank you very much. Thank you. Are they gone? Yeah, they're gone. Our country has to toughen up, folks. We have to toughen up. These people are bringing us down. Remember that. They're bringing us down. No reason for it.
Sounds from a Donald Trump rally in Missouri last week, and the Trump campaign postponed a rally on Friday at the University of Illinois at Chicago in the wake of fights between supporters and demonstrators. Trump is leading as the Republican presidential nominee in Wisconsin and around the nation. In the latest Marquette Law School poll, 30% of those who say they'll vote in the Republican primary support Trump. Pundits, analysts, media, and even Republicans have been trying to figure out why some Republicans support a candidate with little political experience and extreme views. Vox staff writer Amanda Taub explored this question in a recent piece. She spoke to political scientists about a theory that could explain Donald Trump's popularity, the rise of American authoritarianism. Amanda, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Well, you looked at data, a lot of that, and you talked to political scientists about the case that the rise of Donald Trump can be explained, and even if you look at it now, foreshadowed by looking at authoritarianism. Why is authoritarianism, as we might see it, being played out today?
So authoritarianism, as political scientists discuss it, is a kind of a psychological disposition that certain people have that makes them very concerned about social change. And when they feel threatened by social change, they tend to support authoritarian leaders and authoritarian policies. And when you think about authoritarian leaders, what the political science literature discusses is this very punitive style that emphasizes force and focuses on what they call outgroups, so groups of outsiders or minorities who they blame for the country's problems and, you know, promise as their political platform to fix the problems by getting rid of that group. And so if you were to kind of clone a political candidate in the lab to fit that profile for the American context, he might look a lot like Donald Trump.
And are authoritarians Republican? Is that the way they're sorting themselves as we know it so far?
So that's right. So the majority of authoritarians at this point are Republicans. It didn't always used to be that way. So political scientists who study this have found that there used to be a very even distribution of authoritarians across both major political parties. But over the past few decades, as the Republican Party has positioned itself as the champion of traditional values and the sort of party that says no to changes like civil rights, equal rights for women, et cetera, that has been very appealing to authoritarians who prize kind of social order and hierarchies and preserving the status quo when it comes to social issues. So over time, they've been filtering into the Republican Party, which means not only that authoritarians are now more likely to be Republican, but also that authoritarians make up a pretty powerful voting bloc within the Republican Party.
Now, you talked to several political scientists who study authoritarianism, some of them who, it sounds like, realized they were onto something early in the Trump campaign. Can you tell us about some of them and what they found?
Sure. So, two of the political scientists who I focused on in my article are Mark Hetherington, who's a professor at Vanderbilt, and Jonathan Weiler, who's at the University of North Carolina. And they wrote a book actually several years ago about the effect of authoritarianism on party polarization in this country. And they kind of predicted in their research years ago that over time that could pave the way for a real authoritarian candidate and also for a broader embrace of authoritarian politics within the Republican Party as a whole. And when I talked to Mark Hetherington when I was reporting this article, he said that when Trump's candidacy first began, he realized how closely that fit his theory, but couldn't quite believe how right he was. So he called Weiler and said, he kept saying, "I can't believe this. I can't believe this. Look at this." But it really fit their theory very closely.
Well, and how do you figure out, if you're a political scientist, whether someone has authoritarian leanings? There are certain questions people might not want to answer, and there are certain things you just can't ask. So how do you get a handle on that?
So that's a really interesting one. So because authoritarianism touches on kind of hot-button social issues, political scientists think it's not a good idea to ask about it directly because people might not be willing to answer questions directly about, you know, how they feel about immigrants or other kind of tense issues. But what they found is that you could very closely predict people's support for authoritarian policies and leaders by asking them four questions about their parenting priorities. So the questions are things like, tell me which one is more important for a child to have, independence or respect for elders, or what's more important, obedience or self-reliance. And these sound like parenting questions, and so they sound fairly innocuous, especially because they're asking people about things that everybody values to some extent. But what they're really doing is asking people to prioritize things like order and hierarchies over things like independence and creativity. So it's really a way to ask people about what their priorities are.
We're talking with Amanda Taub of Vox right now about the rise of what some political scientists say is an authoritarianism movement in the United States, talking about how that could relate to Donald Trump's popularity. And Amanda, what do we know about what binds these new authoritarians in the United States together? Do they have common platforms that they're interested in? What do we know?
So I would say there are policy preferences that they share, but there are also fears that they share. So in writing my article, we conducted some polling of a large national sample by partnering with a polling and media company called Morning Consult. And what their poll found was that people who scored high on this authoritarian parenting scale were also much more likely to be concerned about a range of what you might think of as social changes in this country. So we asked them whether they thought things like same-sex couples being allowed to marry were good or bad for the country, how they felt about Muslim Americans building mosques in American cities, and various other kind of things like that that were meant to measure people's attitudes towards social change. We also asked how they felt about white Americans becoming a demographic minority in the future, things like that. And what we found was across the board, people who were more high scoring in authoritarianism were much more likely to say that these kind of social changes were bad or very bad for the country. That wasn't true universally. For instance, affirmative action was unpopular with pretty much all respondents to our sample, so there wasn't a huge gap there. But on a lot of these issues, authoritarians were really kind of distinguished by their discomfort with that. And then on the flip side of that, there were some policy preferences that really united them. So they were much more likely, for instance, to say that the United States should use force rather than diplomacy against countries that threaten our interests overseas. And they were also much more likely to support policies that sacrifice civil liberties in order to prevent terrorist attacks.
So it sounds like a more active approach to these policies is what you're describing.
I would say it's a more active approach, but it's also one that's very focused on kind of enforcement and punitive measures, and that really de-emphasizes measures that depend on trust. So, for instance, diplomacy is really a matter of negotiation and kind of building a consensus through trust and shared interests. And we found that our authoritarian respondents were very skeptical of that as a process.
Now, one question that comes up if you run with this theory is how big is this group of potential authoritarians? And it sounds as though it can be hard to get a handle on because these political scientists say that a lot of people, or at least a group of people, are latent authoritarians. Can you talk about what that is and how that might get changed?
Sure. So, first of all, to answer your question, authoritarianism as a matter of scoring high on this policy preference scale is pretty common. So most surveys find that around 40% of Americans score as somewhat high or very high authoritarians. So this is by no means a kind of fringe or rare disposition. But what political scientists find is that even if people have that disposition, it doesn't necessarily affect their political behavior. And the thing that really makes the difference is whether they feel threatened. So that could be threatened by social change, or it could be threatened by what political scientists term physical threats, which is something like a terrorist attack or war. But what the threats tend to have in common is that they tend to be associated with kind of unfamiliar or threatening people. So they could be associated with a foreign government, a terrorist organization like ISIS, or a social group within the U.S. kind of changing its position in society or becoming more powerful.
We're talking right now with Amanda Taub of Vox, talking about the rise of authoritarianism in the United States and how it could relate to Donald Trump's popularity right now. And you can read her article on that subject on the Central Time Facebook page. And we're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. Why do you think Donald Trump has been so popular in this election cycle? What do you think about the relationship between what could be authoritarianism and Donald Trump's popularity? And do you think we're seeing the birth, maybe, of a new splinter GOP based on authoritarianism? Call now at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're picking up our discussion now with Amanda Taub from Vox. She's been reporting on the relationship that some political scientists see between authoritarianism and the success of Donald Trump. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you make of the tie between authoritarianism and the popularity of Donald Trump, as some political scientists are seeing it? Do you think that fears of ISIS and waves of social change are creating fear and causing more people to look towards an authoritarian leader? Call now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Amanda, one thing we haven't gotten into yet is, what does this mean for the Republican Party? I mean, Donald Trump seems to be, well, he's in the Republican Party, but he doesn't seem to be necessarily of the Republican Party.
I think that's right. I think that what this research suggests is that Trump has managed to kind of seize this large and kind of potent minority within the party. And right now that means that he is leading in the polls. But this has the potential to really splinter the party, because although there's some overlap between Trump's policies and broader GOP policies, it's certainly not universal. He is you know, really splitting from conservative orthodoxy in all sorts of ways. And you can see that this really has the Republican Party worried. You've seen all of these more establishment candidates come out and say, you know, the thing we have to do is stop Trump. Mitt Romney obviously made the speech. And Kasich and Rubio have been saying similar things in the past few days. And it seems like the Republican Party just doesn't really have a plan for how to deal with this large block of voters who are very interested in this kind of authoritarian policy platform and authoritarian candidate, but really not particularly interested in the GOP's more traditional economic platform.
Let's get to our callers now. We've got Kyle joining us from Dubuque, Iowa. Kyle, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think for me, as far as I go and people I hang around with, we're just tired of same old politics with them, basically the Democrats, buying votes by promising we'll give you free health care, we'll give you free welfare, we'll give you heating assistance, rental assistance, free phones. There's no need for you to work. We'll find someone else to pick up your bill.
And Kyle, yeah. why does Donald Trump address that for you rather than, I don't know, Marco Rubio?
He addresses the immigration issue, which Marco Rubio does not. The Democrats, as far as I'm concerned, they want more and more immigration in for the same thing, more votes. We'll get them in, we'll allow them to vote, and we'll give them everything we can. And this will buy us more votes.
Kyle, thanks so much for the thoughts. Appreciate that. And Amanda, does that comment seem to jive with what you're talking about here, or is this something different?
It was obviously only a brief moment that we heard from Kyle there, but I think that one thing his comment really showed was this kind of focus on what political scientists call outgroups. So in this particular case, immigrants, he came out and said that the reason he favors Trump over other candidates is that Trump has promised to take action on immigration, and that's absolutely been a hallmark of Trump's campaign and his supporters, that it's very focused on the dangers of outsiders, including immigrants, and has this very punitive set of policies that he's promised. You know, it would be extremely cruel if he actually went through with his promised policy to deport all unauthorized immigrants in this country. That would be, you know, tearing apart American families, not to mention just tremendously expensive and disruptive as a thing for the government to do. But there's a real appetite for that. I think people are very concerned about the ways that their communities are changing, and associating that with immigrants, particularly for people with this authoritarian mindset, is something that is very appealing to a lot of people.
And we're going to move next to Pete. Pete is joining us in Green Bay. Pete, hello.
Good afternoon, ladies. I think Kyle makes my point wonderfully. The Trump or the authoritarian voters believe a few bullet points. They believe, A, everyone in this country is on welfare, and that they're the only ones that work, and that they're the only ones that pay taxes. They also believe that illegal immigrants are voting in wide numbers. I just don't think that they really understand. I'm not going to call them wrong, but I don't. If you ask them simple questions about the political process, they seem to get a lot of things wrong, like how a bill becomes a law.
Pete, I think we got the gist of that there. And both sides, I think, accuse the other of not really understanding the politics, not really voting in their own best interests. That's kind of a hallmark of politics. But does that have an aspect when we look at the angle of authoritarianism, Amanda?
So one thing I think is pretty interesting is that Donald Trump actually is not particularly conservative when it comes to economic issues. You know, one of the big criticisms he's gotten from the right is that he is insufficiently conservative on health care. And I think that one thing that his widespread support suggests is that perhaps people are a little bit less concerned about the specifics of government programs and a little bit more concerned about their fears for the direction this country is taking. And therefore, somebody like Trump, who says, you know, I hear your fears, you're correct, and I'm going to take really extreme action to do something about it, is able to capture their votes in a way that a more traditional conservative who might promise to cut social programs and welfare and things like that just hasn't been able to do this election cycle.
We're talking right now with Amanda Taub, a staff writer for Vox. She's joining us to talk about the relationship between what political scientists are seeing as a rise in authoritarianism and the candidacy of Donald Trump, which, Amanda, they say does not stop with Donald Trump. He may be a product of it, according to this group of people you worked with, but they said he may be just the beginning.
That's right. The dynamics that fuel Trump's candidacy and the voters who are supporting him are not going to go away if he loses the election. So I think that we can expect this authoritarian dynamic to have a significant effect on American politics for quite a long time.
Let's go next to Brad. Brad is joining us in Little Chute. Hi, Brad.
Hi there. Wanted to ask Amanda if she believes there's a connection between authoritarianism and the amygdala part of the brain, or as it's sometimes pronounced, the amygdala. The London University did a study. The amygdala is the part of the brain that is responsible for the fight or flight syndrome. So it has to deal with fear. And a lot of times, if you've got an overactive amygdala, you have sometimes some irrational fears. Any ideas on that?
Brad, thanks for that. Brad's getting into brain science there, but what do we know about the connection again with fear?
So I, in my reporting, really wasn't focusing on the physical aspects of this. Certainly, you know, there are centers of the brain that focus on fear, and authoritarianism is a phenomenon that relates to fear. But I think that this is not just something people are born with. It is also something that's cultural, something that can be learned. And so I think not worth thinking about in terms of these people are so different from us and the differences are inherent and can't be changed, but it's really more of a spectrum.
And Amanda, go ahead.
And the other thing I was going to say is that researchers have found that supporting these kind of authoritarian policies and authoritarian leaders is a fairly common response to people feeling very threatened and fearful. And the thing that really separates people who are authoritarians from non-authoritarians is not the fear response, but what makes them feel afraid. So authoritarians are more likely to feel threatened by people, by social issues, and less likely to feel threatened by kind of more faceless physical threats. In our polling, we asked about car accidents, for instance, and they were much less concerned about car accidents than they were about things like terrorism, even though for Americans in this country, you're actually much more likely to get hurt in a car accident than in a terrorist attack.
As we start to wrap up, Amanda, what does all this research say about authoritarianism and the future of American politics?
So I think that there are two things that I think could have a real effect on American politics going forward. One is the polarization and the growing power of authoritarians within the Republican Party means that there could be a really significant split within the party between kind of GOP authoritarians and more classical conservative voters. And then the second thing is that when people are very afraid, they behave more like authoritarians in terms of their political preferences. And that means that if we see more terrorist attacks, if we see more war that people feel personally threatened by or other issues like that, that could boost the chances of a candidate like Trump. And so since you have both of those things going on at the same time, I think that that adds a real level of unpredictability to the future of American politics.
Amanda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Amanda Taub, staff writer for Vox, joining us there to talk about her reporting on the relationship between authoritarianism and the rise of Donald Trump. And you can find a link to her story and all her research on the Central Times Facebook page. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll talk to a state capitol reporter about today's marathon session in the Senate. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is back tomorrow. News is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.